This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I thought he screwed up the time, all right, because it wasn't going to be my fault. That's for damn sure. Joining the program is somebody I've never met. I've only known him on the on Facebook, and in addition to that, he's actually from the American Army. So join me in welcoming to All Marine Radio, Anthony Dries. Anthony, good morning. I thought I missed you.
No. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me on, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
I called, and when you didn't answer, I thought, you know what? He didn't notice that I said 8 o'clock Pacific time, because I messaged him earlier last night, and he said, I'm ready. And then I didn't respond to it this morning. I thought, he meant he was ready then, 8 o'clock his time, 6 o'clock my time. No, I'm going to be talking to myself for the next hour.
No. I'm Army, so I'm ready all the time.
There you go. You know, that reminds me of something I heard a prostitute say in the Philippines, right? And I'm sorry that that's where this comes from. I wish that wasn't my life. But believe it or not, when we put into places on boats as Marines, right, we don't go to the same pier that, like, the Carnival cruise ship ties up to. We're not at that. And so she said, Marlene, come on, I love you. It's like, nah, that's right. Nah, you understand. I love Army, Navy, and Air Force only on payday, but I love Marines all the time. I was like, yeah.
That's awesome.
Exactly. You're a sales guy. You got to appreciate that.
Yep. That's right. You got to have product differentiation. So you did a good job in that.
There you go. Anthony, we have to meet you, and because you have a unique story, but you don't know this, but I do. We are on parallel kind of courses in the universe.
How so?
Relative to the work, you're going to find out, relative to the work that you're doing in Denver, right? Are you in Denver today?
Right.
Okay.
Yes,
that's where you live. You know what? I'm also, I lived in Grand Forks, North Dakota. You went to the University of North Dakota?
I lived in North Dakota. That's where I'm from. I live in Colorado now, but I grew up and I was raised in North Dakota. I graduated Red River High School.
My oldest son graduated from Red River High School.
Yep. That's awesome. Small world. Great things come out of North Dakota, don't they?
That's the cake eater school in town. That's where the rich kids go.
That's right. I had to earn my way up to that after getting kicked out of the Valley and that other stuff, and I got a last chance at the rich kids school, and I made it work. So
really? See, that's where my kids went to school, Valley and Grand Forks Central High School.
Yep.
Wow, how funny. How funny.
Yeah, small world,
it,
huh?
It is a small world. I was talking a little bit earlier on the program today about, and you'll see similar veins to the work that you're doing, about the mental health path of a warrior, okay? And in the Marine Corps, you join, in our case, the Marine Corps, and we have this thing, it's in our song, you know, first to fight for right and freedom, and to keep your honor clean. Well, you don't realize until you go fight what keep your honor clean means. Keep your honor clean means you have to live with the shit that you do in combat.
Yes, forever.
You have to. You have to put your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And but we don't understand that. You know, we're going. People are going to war, and you know, you hear all these stories, and so that's part of the journey. In that, while you're on active duty, you should get lectured on a few things. One, we expect you to have mental health issues. Okay, you can't be in this life and death business and see the things that you're going to see and experience the things you're going to experience and not talk to people and not have issues. So it's just like another physical issue. It's not a big deal to us. We expect it. We've accounted for it. We accept it. And so that's your active duty life. You grow up in kind of a mature mental health environment, which is not the case today, I might add. Or it might [S2] Right. [S1] Be in some places, and it might not be in other places. Then when you leave, in my opinion, I'd be curious to get your thoughts about this, the mental health approach by the VA is completely and utterly wrongheaded. There should be a triage process. I would say that 90% of the people that show up at the VA need to be retrained in how to deal with their life as they go about trying to live the life they want to live, except they got some more junk in their trunk, right? Now, we've been trained. We're warriors. We're disciplined. We're driven, and we live purpose-driven lives. And so we understand training. If you give me this training, and I understand how to translate that training into wellness practices for my life, I can do that. I can learn to coexist with the monsters that are under my bed, as Rihanna sings. And so then the thing that connects the whole thing together is I then, armed with this training, and I'm not on meds, and I'm going about my life, I can then help other people, civilians that are affected by trauma, and I continue this purpose-driven life that I began when I was a fairly young man or woman. And I can touch those people and their lives by telling them, hey, it's okay. It's okay to be damaged. It's okay. It's okay to have bad days because you're not going to get over it, right? Let me help you and kind of turn you on to some stuff that will help you to help ease your pain. But you're okay. We can do that all over the world. And when you come home from that experience, and Anthony, you've had them, I describe it as like when the Grinch's heart gets bigger when he hears the Who people singing. And I don't know, is the Grinch a guy? Do we really know the Grinch is a man? I don't even know. I just thought that. Maybe the Grinch is a woman, which would explain a lot of the behavior. But anyway, the visual of the Grinch's heart growing, I love that, right? But that's what you feel when you touch somebody's life. And so tell me we're not on parallel tracks in the universe.
Michael, I can't tell you that because what you said is absolutely the truth. And I would add to what you said just the following. You know, we can take a person, a civilian kid, a punk kid, quite frankly, and in 9 weeks or 12 weeks, we can turn that punk kid, be it male, female, any gender, I don't care, we can take that person and turn them into a rootin' tootin' son of a gun in 8, 9, 10, 12 weeks, whatever. Further, if you give us a few more weeks, we'll give them an occupational specialty besides being a killer, right?
Right.
And so we understand that that type of immersion training works great in the military environment. Why then don't we take, as you said, and it's been something I've been saying in my speeches a lot, why then are we not having the mental wellness conversation? Why are we not saying to our young warriors, hey, this is what it looks like when you have mental issues or PTSD or whatever war, battle, fatigued, whatever we want to call it. And I agree with PTSD. What I'm frustrated with, the reason why I said that is because some people are more intent on changing the acronym than worrying about the problem.
Right.
I don't care what we call it.
Yeah.
It's a problem. So you can call it what you want. What I'm saying is we need to make sure that we identify what those behaviors look like and how they feel and whatever. And the best way to do that is come from other warriors that have been there. And so then that way there's no stigma or shame associated with it. It's just what warriors do. Further, I feel like our problems as veterans and as people that have served our country, if you look at their top five problems, they've largely remained the same since I've retired from military in 92. Job issues, home issues, in terms of family, education, access to adequate housing, and those are probably the top ones. But then you go into alcoholism, addiction, opioids, and so there's several others after that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would share with you all the things that are the top five or top seven issues that veterans face and that we have been facing for over 25, closer to 30 years that I've been a veteran. We could solve a lion's share of that by training our warriors up front. Add it to the basic training. Like financial literacy, that causes more issues to a person that's having the other issues that warriors face, right? Like that exacerbates it. So if you're struggling with PTSD and you're struggling to pay your bills at the same time, your PTSD can't really get better because you've got stressors that are keeping it triggered. If this person knew,
you know,
a warrior knew,
I see that.
How to manage their finances from the get-go, then a lot of the problems that they face on the other end of the transition are alleviated. And I just want to say one more thing on this topic, Michael. I feel like we have transitioning. We need to revisit the definition. We don't transition once as veterans. That's what we think. We think when we ETS, that's our transition, and that's it. And further, that's what the military thinks. They're like, within a year of your transition, we'll give you additional training and whatever else. So we got it wrong because that's like sprint training. Training for a sprint when transitioning is really a marathon. I'm 50 years old. I've been transitioning for almost 30 years. And so it never ends. And I think when you think that it ends on Tuesday, if I finish this class or if I finish my assignment or my duty, then it's over. Well, it's not terminal. Like you said, it's a process. It's a part of your life. And so when you learn to manage it that way, then I don't think the consequences feel so daunting all the time.
My guest, who I've never even spoken to in my life until a few minutes ago when he missed my phone call, is Anthony Dries. Unbeknownst to me, he's from the state of North Dakota, where I lived and raised my kids for 14 years. He got booted out of the North End schools, so he never crossed paths with me. Well, he was gone before I got there. But I probably know some of the people that threw him out of school. Because we come from that part of the country, I don't joke. I say this with great sincerity, but people think I'm joking. I'd rather be shot at any day of the week than lay in bed, look at the ceiling, and not know how I'm going to pay my bills. And testament to that is the suicide rate among farmers when they fail.
Right.
Do a little search on that number that continues to increase when somebody is faced with losing a family farm that's been in their family for three or four generations.
Yes, sir. I should let you know, Michael, you're hitting me on all cylinders. So I got to North Dakota. I was an Air Force brat. My stepfather was in the Air Force, and it wasn't a great home life. And so part of the reason why I was having issues, quite frankly, behaving and all that stuff, that got me booted from the bad school to the new school or whatever, because I got adopted. And so the folks that adopted me are from North Dakota. Their name are John and Vivian Dries. John, God rest his soul, passed away about 4 years ago. But they farmed almost 8,000 acres, and they took me in. They already had six kids, and they adopted me as the oldest kid of their seven kids.
Wow.
Yep. And so my family is actually white. So I'm raised black, white, whatever. And so that's why I understand the human condition. It's not a condition of color. Yes, Black Lives Matter. Yes, Marine Lives Matter. Yes, Women's Lives Matter. That's not it. What matters is when we have a situation, it's most likely a misunderstanding of a misunderstanding. It's been my experience, and I'm only 51, almost 51, so I could be getting this wrong. But on my experience, it's been mostly a misunderstanding of a misunderstanding. And the way people act in their misunderstanding, and I'm as guilty as anyone throughout the years, if I misunderstand you, then I only have the tools that I've been trained to respond, right?
Right.
And so in the big issue is in population. There's such a small population that actually serves in our military, so that when we share the information with them, regardless of how they feel about it, they're not exactly certain how to respond. And so it's been my experience in living both among white, black, military, whatever. I've got a master's degree, so I've spent a little time around academia. I'm an executive director, and I've been a C-suite executive for several years of my career, so I understand that side. And all that is just to say that no person that I've ever run into, very few people, are all the way wrong. No people are all the way right.
What?
I've seen five or six people have different perspectives.
You've only just met me.
Thing.
You've only just met me. I know you said that no people I know are completely right, but you have to footnote that by saying I only met Mac. I only met Mac a few minutes ago, and he might change this for me.
Right, with the caveat that I just recently met Mike today. So,
there you go.
The point of it is simply that if we insist that here's the thing. I don't have to convince myself of my way of thinking. Then why am I always shouting it from the mountaintop? What I'm more interested in is what's your way of thinking? And how does it blend, or how does it intersect, or how does it oppose what I think? And can any of us have new perspective? And once we start seeing that new perspective, Michael, and we take the time to process the communications that we're trying to establish in the world, then we can form together as a community and solve some of these challenges. My biggest issue in this world right now, as I look around, I got to back up a little bit and just tell you how I got here, while you're talking to me even. In 1991...
Hold on.
Okay. You're not ready for that. Okay.
Well, no, we'll do that in a second, but here, my experience is almost identical. And okay. What I call it is if when you articulate what you're thinking and you begin to footnote why you think that, right? And then I listen, I articulate what I think, and I footnote, or you articulate what you think, I articulate what I think, and there's a difference between them. And then say, okay, well, explain this to me, which is essentially doing footnotes. Like, I spent the first 24 years of my life never reading a footnote. And then, I don't know, I think at the age of 29, I find out that it's all in the footnotes, okay?
Yeah, the answers are all here, right?
And so,
the answers are at the bottom of the page.
Right, they're all there. It's all there. So then I footnote, and you find out, oh, okay, I get it. So we're only talking about the difference between that and that. I got it. And so, but if you're too busy yelling at each other, if you're too busy to be right, you know, trying to be right and not trying to understand.
Or if you're too busy in a society that's trying to divide us, I want you to understand, in my lifetime, I was born during the time of Vietnam and the civil rights. And so I've been a black guy my whole life. I've never felt the tension in our society. And it's not necessarily, yes, it's about black and white, but I don't feel it because of black and white.
I don't think it is.
I feel a divide in our society, and I feel like it's a top-down driven divide. I feel like it's intentional.
Can I give you an opinion about that? What you see on the nightly news, that's not America that you know, that I know, that you live in, that I live in. It is a slicked-up version of the Jerry Springer show to drive clicks that drives revenue. That's what that is.
And fear. Yes. Yeah,
and fear. And it stokes it. And if you shut that off, and if you form your opinions by the Americans that you interact with, the way Americans respond to disaster and when people need help, it's not what you see on TV. What you see on TV is driven by companies that need you to watch, and they've essentially become the Jerry Springer show. Do something absolutely stupid. Light yourself on fire and get on national TV. That's what it takes.
Right.
But that is not the country that I live in. That's not the military I serve in. And again, we've elected a black American to the presidency twice, right? One of the fastest growing categories demographically in the United States is children of mixed race. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you live through this,
the world's going to be beige, baby. Unfortunately, whether you like it or not, right? But just think about it. It's actually the melting pot, and for several generations, people kind of kept it themselves. And it's funny we talk about North Dakota. So if you go to North Dakota, you pretty much get Germans And Swedish are Norwegians up there, right?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of branches. There's not a whole lot of branches in that family tree, okay? It's like one big trunk going straight up.
Well, and so that's all to say that during those generations, people made note of their ethnicity, and they were trying to maintain their heritage and their traditions and stuff like that generationally. Now, how do people identify themselves? My kids are mixed. So, depends on their situation. Like, if they're doing something, then they're black. If they're not, then they're doing something white. And so it doesn't matter. They just become people. And I feel like as soon as the world, and it's going that way, but as soon as we stop fighting ourselves and evolve to be what America's gonna be and do it uniformly, and here's the thing, I'm not all altruistic. I don't think we're all gonna sit and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. I'm a warrior, don't get it wrong. At the same time, no one has to lose necessarily. So for me or the people that I serve who happen to be veterans, for us to win, you don't have to lose. Someone else doesn't have to lose. And they don't even have to necessarily give up their piece of pie. That's the thing that I don't think society gets. And I think that's the part that are the people that are driving this divisive time, they're capitalizing on it. And they're trying to just make it wider and wider. And don't get me on the whole gun topic. So let us divide us and then take away our firearms. Then what are we?
No, you know, and I even
I feel that.
You know, typical this week though, if you listen to John McCain's final speech on the floor of the Senate, right? I don't think that you look at the way that body behaves and talk about division, they don't work together anymore. They don't compromise.
No.
Because they say, well, we can't do that or we'll get destroyed on talk radio and on television. You don't have the courage to do that.
Right.
You don't have the courage that it takes for a 19-year-old PFC would have. You don't have that kind of courage, then the country's screwed, and you're a failure. And so our nation wrestles with that. Okay, but I want to hit pause right now.
Okay.
And we want to meet you to know if we should listen or believe any of the shit you're going to say. Okay, so born and raised where?
I was born in Dayton, Ohio, on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I was not a welcome child. I was not on purpose. I was actually, as I understand it, my biological mom's first encounter. After that, I was born. I stayed there with my mother and my grandparents. I spent about 3 years there, and then she got married. We ran off and did all the Air Force places. I lived in Florida, California. I've been to Thailand as a kid and wound up in North Dakota. Our relationship perished there, and so at the age of 13, my mom gave me up for adoption. Fortunately, I had been living in the foster home for a short amount of time before that with, as I mentioned before, John and Vivian Dries. In hindsight, I can only say this. Without my experience with my birth mother, I wouldn't be hard as woodpecker lip. Like, I wouldn't be the son of a bitch I am about pain. I couldn't do that. And that's not to validate any of the behavior or the treatment that I had, but it's factual now as I look back on it. However, switching the switch and then living with my new family, it was exactly the opposite of the coin. So as a young man, I had a very, very mature perspective on the world. I understood how people could treat each other and how people should treat each other. So after 3 years in special education, I graduated at age 17. I was already enrolled in college with my new family. As soon as I turned 18 in November.
Okay, hold on. Hey, where did the Dreeses live? Did they live outside Grand Forks?
They live just 3 miles south of North Dakota. We farmed roughly about 7,800 acres. John Dries was the youngest of 10 kids, and they homesteaded in North Dakota back in the 1800s.
Wow. What kind of farm?
Yeah.
What'd they grow?
No livestock. It was sugar beets. It was wheat. It was, we're certified seed potatoes and certified seed sugar beets. So those are our two big cash crops. We did beans and I say big cash crops, so that's a joke if you know farming. But
but sugar beets in North Dakota, in that section of North Dakota, is huge. And when the beet harvest, I actually drove a truck in the beet harvest. Yeah, how about
it's
that?
It's on right now. Yeah, it's on right now.
Exactly.
It's the time. What's going on right now? I think it's probably day three or something, right?
Yeah. And the whole, everybody knows it. It's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle.
Let me ask you this. How blessed are you that by I don't know, the grace of God, by fortune, whatever, that the Dries family came into your life?
Man, I tell them sometimes, like, I don't know if you have kids or not, but when my kids give me compliments and stuff, and I just kind of, on the inside, it really warms you up.
Right.
I tell those folks more times than I can count, thank you for saving my life. I used to tell them that shit when I was a little kid. I was like, thank you, you saved me. Like, I was in a situation, it was going to be either he or me. Right? And I was prepared for it at age 13. Do you understand that? Like, I was ready for that. I knew that was imminent.
No, and I don't understand that. Right? I can't.
Yeah, and I'm glad you don't. I'm more fortunate my kids don't understand that. And that's my blessing. And so your question started with how blessed or how fortunate am I? And yes, I believe in God. I'm a man of God. I'm a warrior of God. I kick ass for God. Right? And so all this stuff I understand now. I didn't understand it then, but I was always fortunate. I've always been grateful. I'm grateful to be alive every day. I get up and kill it because I'm happy to be alive. So, yes, I'm very blessed. I know it. I'm very grateful. I teach gratitude to my kids. I teach gratitude to every person I come in contact with. If you're not grateful, how can you get more?
No, it starts with acknowledging what you have before you progress to something else. All right, so you graduate from Red River High School, home of the Rough Riders, named after Theodore Roosevelt.
Rough Riders.
Yeah, home of the cake eaters in the south end of Grand Forks. With the working people living in the north end of Grand Forks. Right? Exactly.
And it's so interesting you say that, because where did they ship the base kit? To the working end. It's not an uncommon practice in any of the states, right? It just is what is. And it happened to be geographically closer, so I'll give them that. But the point of the matter is, that's what veterans and military families are. We're blue-collar Americans. We're the working class.
Right?
No doubt. Don't discard us. Don't give us a poor education. Like, the military is actually, for a lot of us, our access to education. But if we see the veterans not being taken care of, what will make us go there? Like, the cost is not... the cost-benefit analysis, it doesn't make sense even for some of our youth. And so that's why, as a veteran, it's important that what you're doing, what I'm doing, it matters. Even if it doesn't matter in our lifetime, it may. Because who we impact with our stories and with our mannerisms, our military bearing, that stuff, it matters. People are watching. They're always watching.
Well, and here's the other thing. They may act like they're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
But you said something... I want to say in the first two sentences that you spoke here, and what you said is, what you're saying is the truth. The truth needs no salesman, okay?
Right.
The truth lands with a thud, and the people that hear it and have lived, they know it.
Mm-hmm.
They know it. And so that's cool. All right, back to you. You graduate from high school. You go to the University of North Dakota. Where do you go to college?
I went to the University of North Dakota, I enrolled in college. My aspiration, so to speak, was I was going to be an executive salesperson, or I was going to be exec for Nike. And since there were no black executives at Nike, I knew my pathway would be to become a salesman. But by the fall of that year, like I said, as soon as I turned 18 in November, I was like, you know what, I'm not built for this, and I've always wanted to be in the Army, and now I'm a grown man, and I'm going. Problem was, they couldn't take me soon enough. I couldn't go until January, so I had to go tell Mrs. Dries why I dropped out of college.
Why didn't you join the Marine Corps, man? What's up with that?
I'm going to say this. I thought about this earlier today.
I'm just going to warn you, be very careful. And don't start this shit with all due respect. Don't even go there
either.
I
never say that shit, because when people say with all due respect to me, I get ready to fight. Like, whatever you're going to say, I hope you can back it up. With all due respect, and go save your ass. So I don't say that. I thought of this, and my impression of the military, I wanted no part of the Air Force just because of my personal relationship. My granddad was a great veteran, and he did a great job serving in the Air Force, but my stepmonster ruined it for me. He really did.
Right.
And I felt like I was built for the Army. The Army had heavy equipment operators and stuff like that, combat engineers, which I was interested in, I thought, at the time. And the Marines... I thought the Marine officers were the most elite of the elite. I felt like they were the thinking man and tough. And I felt like the Marine guys had a higher propensity of directly going to war. And I wasn't necessarily joining the Army to go to war, right? I was joining the Army to serve the country, to get the experience, get the adventure, and if need be, I'd go to war happily. But I wasn't necessarily, I didn't want that to be my primary mission because I already had so much violence in my life.
And listen,
right?
Okay, so listen to you. You don't want to join the Marine Corps, okay, because the Marine Corps is like hell-bent to go fight someplace. Okay, so let me stay away from
right.
that. Let me join the Army. And then what happens to you? You get sent to war.
Well, wait a minute.
You get sent to war, then you get your ass blown up, okay? That'll teach you.
That'll show me. That'll learn me. But the thing of it is, I'm never afraid of getting... I wasn't afraid of going to war. That wasn't my only intent and purpose. I want you to understand that. So, right? Like, when it,
right.
when it, okay, I'll finish the story. Let me tell you how I got there. So I did 4 years of active duty in the United States Army. I was in during the Cold War. I had a PRP... I had a secret clearance and I was PRP reliability.
Right.
I got to hang out and do some really cool stuff that 18-year-old kids didn't get to do. Further, I became a truck driver. I'll tell you how I picked truck driver. I'm sitting in the recruiter's office. They have these top-load VCRs with a long wired remote control.
Right.
And they got this library of films. They're MLS films. He's like, based on your GT score, you can do whatever you want. And so he gave me a list of MLSs and put it down there. He goes, these are the ones with the highest bonuses. I just looked up at him and said, thanks. And so I went down at the first one of Airborne Business Administrator. I didn't have typing. I couldn't get it done by the time I wanted to go. That was out. The next one with the highest one was 64 Charlie. I put in the video. I said, is this it? I started laughing. I pointed at the TV. I said, this is the job? It was truck driver. I was like, man, I'm a goddamn farm kid. Okay. And so I watched it. And then we started fording rivers and snorkeling and all this stuff. I was like, dude, sign me up for this. And that's how I started. And I had skills, but as soon as I got there, they recognized I had skills. And so they trained me. And like you said, I went there for the training. So I did it. I got great. As a private, I was doing stuff that staff sergeants and whatever, they weren't allowed to do. They didn't have the proficiency, and they didn't have the clearance. I learned about access through having expertise.
Right.
I got to stop and tell you a little bit about John Drees real quick. This guy, he is 6'3", about 240. Big guy. He looked like a polar bear, or like a big bear, right? I thought, oh, God. And you got to understand my background. So when I came there, I was like, oh, I can't imagine what it's going to be like to take a beating from this big guy. That guy never put a hand on me, ever. He was the kindest, most soft-looking guy you ever saw. And the thing I noticed, I told you as a kid, I was astute. What I noticed is that every person that ever was in trouble or ever needed anything called John Drees. Further, he had 7 kids. Every activity that we had, he was there. Even in times like harvest, he'd show up. He might be dirty and whatever. He looked like he came out of, fell out of the oil pan of the truck. He'd stand there. He'd say, how do you make sure you've seen him? Did his thing, and then he had to go back to work. This guy was an incredible guy. And I asked him one day, I said, hey, Dad, how come people come to you? He goes, oh, that. And he kind of chuckled. He goes, Tony, let me tell you something. He said, in your life, there's some things that you love to do. He said, do those to a level that no one else can do them better than you. And he said, then repeat it 4 or 5 times. He said, then you'll be an expert. Then you can really help people. He goes, you'll never have to advertise a day in your life. They'll come looking for you. And I've always had that mentality. And it carried me in the Army. And right away, I was like getting proof all the time from this guy. And so the Army, what he said was true. I'd do something stupid, get busted down to from PFC to E2 or something. Didn't matter. My job, my proficiency never changed. It kept going up and up. And so I was always on the radar for the mission. The mission, the mission, the mission. Drees is on it. And that gave me a feeling of pride and accomplishment that, as I understand now, it helped me carry myself and sustain myself through even some very difficult times. So I did 4 years in the Army in Germany. My last duty station was in Frankfurt, Germany. For a single Army dude, that was the joint. And I was on the road every single day. So it was perfect for me. In January, I left at ETS. I went back to Grand Forks, North Dakota, University of Phoenix. I mean, University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. I was in the ROTC program as a aeronautical studies major.
Right.
I was also on the ROTC Ranger Challenge Team. So the Ranger Challenge Team is where we go and do a bunch of the Army stuff, like one rope bridging, 10-mile ruck rush, PT test. I think we took 5 or 6 weapons, totally disassembled them, throw them in a metal trunk, and then we have relay races to run down and assemble the weapons, and then whatever team wins, assembling all 6 weapons wins, and whatever, things like that. It was man, what a hoot. But it also kept me in shape for my Army skills. So this is 1990, January of 90.
Got it.
By August of 1990, Desert Shield began. In August of 1990, myself and a couple of my college friends, I saw them in Texas a while ago, but we walked down to the recruiter. And I walked up to the recruiter and said, hey, I'm prior service. I just got out in January. If we're going to war, I'm going. And the guy said, nope, we don't take prior service. And right now, why don't you just go enjoy college? That's what he said to me. So, I know. I did an about face. I looked at my friends and shrugged, and we went back to school. We were the state champions. We stomped NDSU. I don't want to say it like that, but we did. And then we were scheduled to come down to Colorado Springs for a national in January of 1991. January 3rd, I'm sitting in my dad's driveway working on my car stereo or something. He walks by and throws a certified letter on my dashboard and keeps walking, goes in the house. I walk in the house after opening it, my whole family, my sister, my mom, my dad, everybody's in there bawling. I was like, well, I guess you know what this letter is. I'm going to war. That's how it came down. I think I recorded in the end of January. We had some messing around. I was in Saudi Arabia for 9 days. My job in Saudi, our job, so what they called our kind of people that were in the military and then out and then back in, reactivated, that's called IRR, Inactive Reservists. And so when you get a bunch of inactive reservists together, there's no majority or anything. It's just a bunch of hodgepodge folks thrown together. Our group, they named us 475th Transportation. It was an official name, but it was just like, okay, you guys go over here and you're going to be called this, right? So it was just an assembled unit. We happened to be sharing the building with 14th Quartermaster. 14th Quartermaster is an Army Reserve water purification unit from Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. In this, we were in Dahran, Saudi Arabia. Our job for my side, for 475th Transportation, we drove blacked out Mercedes-Benz, meaning no headlights, no chrome, no stuff like that. And our mission every night is to take jet fuel to the front lines for the tanks, because that's what they run on.
Got it.
So when we were talking about the Marines not wanting to get dead, I want you to understand the life expectancy of an 88 mic at the time of a truck driver. If we go to war, every MOS has a life expectancy. So it says if you go to war, if this is your job, this is how many minutes you're slated to live, right? So a normal 88 mic's life expectancy, if I remember correctly, it was like 11 minutes. And I remember it.
Why? Why are the truck drivers getting whacked?
In war, in our particular situation, our life expectancy was 2 minutes. I wanted to tell you that. 2 minutes.
Why? Who's going
to
kill you?
Jet fuel. It's jet fuel, and there's one highway to get to where we need to get. So if you're the enemy, what would you do? So anyway, we didn't have to worry about that necessarily. But what we did, our biggest threat wasn't necessarily like that. We can handle that. That's the job. Our biggest threat, Michael, every night, about 9 o'clock, about 8:30, 9 o'clock, by the time you would put your kids to bed if you had little ones, every night we'd hear the air raid siren.
Right.
And I can't tell you how eerie that feels. Just think of it as making the little hairs on the back of my neck stand up. But if the air raid siren that you hear in movies and on TV, yeah, it's legit. And so what the protocol was, we're in this big I-beam framed corrugated steel building. Like a metal outbuilding is what we call them out here in Colorado or in North Dakota. They're like farm buildings, right?
Right.
But this is a big one. It was used as a warehouse. And it was so big, actually, it had a cherry picker. And so what a cherry picker is, you crawl up the ladder and you sit in it, and then you can go laterally down the sides of the warehouse. And then it has an arm that goes out forward and backward. So you could pick up a pallet in the middle of the warehouse, even if the entire warehouse was full. You follow me?
Yep.
Okay. So I picked the ladder underneath the cherry picker. I was like, oh, look, this is a great place. I can hang my towels. I can hang my laundry. Like, I'm like a warrior. I'm like, I'm improving my position. Like, this is my spot. It just so happened that was in a corner, a highly reinforced corner, because the cherry picker was up there. It's important. So every night, you hear if you would hear the air raid siren, what the protocol is to close all the doors, grab your helmet, put it on and fasten it, and then make sure that you hold or have fastened to your body your protective mask. We were really concerned about chemical agents and stuff during the Gulf War, with good reason. But
right.
So then what happened? So this happened the first night we got there. So here's how it went down. You hear, close the door. Everybody close the door. We get on our helmets and we sit there. And then all of a sudden you hear, boom. You're, phew. And you hear this big kaboom, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden you hear this. Like metal shrapnel raining on the building that we were in. 8 days in a row. Metal of shrapnel of a Patriot destroyed Scud missile directly overhead. And so then as the Patriots break up the Scud missile, you can hear the debris fall on your position. I want to make sure that's clear.
Nice.
When you walk outside in the morning or after that, some of the debris actually can stick in your boots. It's sharp, it's jagged, it's whatever. On the ninth night, me and the boys just got done playing football. Concrete building, so you can tell how rough we are. We just got done playing tackle football. And one of the sergeants goes, hey, you guys knock it off, someone's gonna get jacked up, not on my watch. Right then the air raid siren went off, and everyone's like, grab your helmet. My helmet was in between two cots. I reached over to get it, and the next thing I know, Michael, I felt the most amazing concussion. Have you ever, if you've been in the military, you've gone to the grenade range.
I hate
when
it.
I was in basic training,
I don't like it.
I remember when we were marching up to it, and there was other people on the range, we were about a quarter mile away, and I remember the concussion I felt under my feet. And I was like, God damn, this stuff is serious, huh? And they're like, yeah, it's not the TV grenades that you see, right? So the only thing that I have that's a good reference point in my life is the grenade range. This, I didn't even hear it. I felt it. And it felt like the grenade range times whatever. Infinity. And so next thing I know, I'm on my knees and I look up from what was fluorescent light and a cherry picker and corrugated steel. I could see nothing but stars. It was pitch black outside and there was no building. The building was gone. And I'm like, oh shit. What happened, what I find out later, is that we were struck by the deadliest Scud missile of the Iraqi war. 106 of us were injured, and 29 of us died. At the time, man, it was tough. I was awake. I stayed awake. And then once I stayed awake, I saw the carnage. I smelt it. I heard it. People's, like, when if you read the Bible, it said in hell there will be gnashing and wailing and weeping and gnashing of the teeth. Yeah, that's what this shit was. Fire and all that. Yes, that's what it was. When they say war is hell, maybe they don't know how to directly articulate it. Let me tell you, the smell of burning flesh, the sound of somebody screaming or crying in agony and then calling out for their other people, you'll never forget it. The sounds of, in my case, I at some point I went to put my shoe on. I was wearing a certain type of basketball shoe that I was very proud of, right? And they were expensive that in those day and age. And so my foot was out of it. I went to put my shoe back on. It was a high top. And then when I went to put my foot in, my leg fell away and normally moved. And I said, oh shit. So then I'm a soldier. Guess what I did? I just did a system check. Okay. My head's bleeding on the side. Check. I'm good up here. My arms are good. Chest is good. What's this blood in the back of my leg? My hand is saturated and it's dripping. Okay. Check the other leg. Same thing. All right. This leg is broken. Clearly this leg feels okay. Between me and ouch is my buddy, who has a pretty awful look on his face, and not a normal one, and a pile of rubble that was once where the wall was. It's probably 4 feet high now. I got three legs, I'm like a dog with three legs. Both my arms are good. I had a couple of, like, surface injuries with shrapnel marks, and I got scars from them. If they were alone, you'd say, God, that was a big cut. But relatively speaking, it was like, okay, so we got a couple marks on our arm, but we're, you know, 9 by 10 of that. And I drug my buddy to the wall, and I called the rest of it out. I stayed there longer than I probably wanted to, but with the blood loss, the fire was really warm. And in the fire, that night, it was a perfect storm, Michael. We had a mission and then it got canceled. So all of us had full M16 magazines, and further, we were storing the other quartermaster guys and whatever. We were storing some ammunition in there, but we also had propane and our other stuff in there.
Nice.
So at some point, I'm sitting in there listening, and, you know, if a round catches on fire, it goes pop,
right.
Pop. So you hear a couple pops. That didn't bother me. The fire felt good. All of a sudden, how about I kept hearing a couple pop, pop, yay, yay. I was like, oh, gotta go, gotta go. I was like, I did not live through this thing to get hit by some hot M16 round that decided to take off and spin because of the fire or whatever. That was this point. I just decided to get up out of there. Had the best ride of my life, wanting to be an aviator, is when the flight of life came for me. They took me to the hospital, and they stabilized me as best they could. I stayed awake. Like, the emergency room nurse, she's now a friend of mine. We've connected since then. And she goes, "You're a beast." I said, "I knew if I fell asleep, I'd be dead. And I didn't want to wake up dead." And so finally, in the ER, I asked them, I was like, "You guys got me?" Like, what? I was like, "Can I pass out now?" They're like, "Yeah, you can go." I wake up in the hospital, and they keep trying to give me morphine. I'm like, no way. I grew up behind Vietnam, right? And I see all this stuff.
Right.
Day four, a set of doctors comes in and goes, "Hey, what's your deal?" I was like, "You guys aren't stringing me out. I don't care. I'll take it." They're like, "Listen, the way you are, you're young, you're strong, blah, 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 blah." Anyway, they got me to take the medicine. That was the start. I started taking the medicine, right? And they told me I needed it to heal and rest and all that stuff. They stabilized me. I go to Germany for a while. They stabilized me better for like a month. ICU, my mom comes there. I'm going to fast forward a little bit because I don't want to do this all afternoon. And then I go to Walter Reed. I get to Walter Reed. Like, within 3 days, I had four people tell me they're going to cut my leg off. A dude walked up to me, a doctor, poked me on the shoulder. He goes, "You're lucky. We almost cut your leg off yesterday." Finally, I said, "You know what? You ain't doing it." And they all stopped what they were doing and turned and looked at me. I'm a PFC. The top guy in the room was the chief of orthopedics. He was a fully board colonel. He was the first one to speak. He turned around and he said, "Why not?" I said, "Because I want to keep it. I made up my mind." He didn't say anything. He thought for a second. He goes, "What do you want us to do?" I said, "All you need to do, sir, is tell me what to do. I promise I'll do it all." And all he said to me is, "I heard therapy work." I said, "Done." So with therapy, I also went in every day and had debridement. And debridement, in my case, was they would lay me on the table at the end of the day and cut the dead skin out of my leg and whatever tissue that looked necrotic or whatever. And I had an open wound. And then we'd pack it with sterile gauze full of saline or whatever, and we'd pack this wound every single day. Long story short is after 9.5 months, People Magazine called me a medical miracle. Because after 58 surgeries, I jogged out of the hospital and went back to my life. For 27 years, I was out there killing it, man. I was doing my thing. Even in 2015, I got an NAACP award for some of the work that I was doing with veterans and education. 2016, a veteran award from Veterans Task Force of Hope. And just on and on, like killing it. And by the time I got 25-year anniversary, so what, 3 years ago? 2.5 years ago?
2.5.
Cancer. Yeah, cancer. Bone infection. Okay, so I went from 58 surgeries
same
to 56
leg.
Surgeries.
Same leg?
Yeah, absolutely same leg. That leg was what people didn't know, and they couldn't tell because I never limped or anything, but I had an open wound the entire time. And so while I was doing everything I could to manage it the way the doctors told me, my doctor that I came to be very close with at the time, my surgeon, he said, "Reese, you got to keep this thing on you until technology catches up with you. That's all we got." Because part of the reason I had a couple implants, my body rejected them. They almost killed me.
Right.
So then I had this major fracture in my femur, and they couldn't do anything, no appliances. So I basically healed, right? Like, I had to heal. So they're like, so my doctor's like, "You just got to manage this." So as far as keeping my wound clean, it was spotless all the time on the outside. What was happening is it was draining. It's called an ulcerative wound. That means it pusses.
Right.
Well, it was pussing on the inside. And what it did is made this tumor, it wrapped around my femur like a snake. And I got to tell you, surgery number 66, that was when they took that tumor out. it almost killed me. More importantly, Mike, it almost killed my spirit. Like, I just, wow. All the surgeries.
Wow, you've had almost 60 surgery. Why does 56 do that?
No, number 66 in particular, like even the ones before that, right. They would go in my leg. My doctor said, I was in there, you've got 350s in your leg. Yeah, an hour after surgery, I was walking up and down the stairs. These guys were like, no way. I'm like, I got this. Don't worry about it. And we did that several times, and everybody, and so I thought it was Superman. They thought I was Superman. When they went to get that cancer out, there was another, my life has been a series of perfect storms, for better or for worse. The hospital changed over stupid, what do you call that, computer system?
Yep.
So they dropped me. They basically just left me overnight with no pain medicine, no one checked on me. And what I did with my smart self is about 3 or 4 hours into it, I decided I was going to go to my private bathroom. I got 3 steps away from the bed. You know, that so close but so far away thing?
Yep.
I was on an island, man. I was in the middle of the ocean. I was in so much pain. Like, all I wanted to do was go back to bed, and it felt so far away. By the time someone came and checked on me at 11 o'clock the next morning, I just broke out in tears. I had nothing left in the tank. All my warrior pain fighting, all my concentration, all my spirit on the hill. And remember, it was on the hills of like 7 more surgeries, back to back to back. And then this one, it almost broke me. It was so painful. I was so unprepared for it, and it just cracked me. And then I also got frustrated because the system, what I didn't tell you along the way is the system jacked me. That's almost a whole other story. But like Social Security, I went in with my medical records, whatever. He said, no problem, it's a shoe-in in person. And then as soon as I follow up with them, they're like, you ain't getting it. You're under 50. Right? Like the lady talked to me like that. And I was like, well, gosh. Funny, you can say that when I was in there and I showed you my book and my picture of me and the president and all this stuff. And you said, oh, we got you, sweetie. Now I'm standing on the porch of the VA, and they tell me I got cancer. She goes, oh, what kind? Some of those are covered. I said, man, that is amazing. You're really treating us like this. So anyway, fast forward a little bit longer. After my surgery, I went out and lived and got in shape. I started, I got a cane corso, a baby puppy. And I just started training. And I started training myself. And I started preparing. I started hopping around on one leg. I started doing my ab workouts. I started doing things to get myself ready because I just felt like it's imminent. And if my path is going to require me to sit and just take a bunch of multiple surgeries again, then I'm going to make the decision to cut my leg off. And so we fast forward to December of last year, 2017. My cancer got bad enough that, and I'm not a chemo guy. I watched it kill too many people. I'm not a radiation guy. I did one series of radiation on my leg. I said, okay, I'll try it. It's local. They're like, we got nothing else for you. If you don't try radiation, then you're just going to die. So I tried it. It was awful. It ruptured my tumor while I was out with my kids or whatever. It was awful. And I was just disintegrating. And we made the decision. I just told my doctor, like, where can I go? Right? I was laying in the VA's in my doctor's office. And I was laying on her couch. I was supposed to be sitting up. We were talking. I was just laying down. I had so much pain. I was like, I'm going to die, and I can't do this here. And my doctor from the university happened to be a doctor from the VA. I didn't like him because, like, 5 years before, he's like, let's cut it off. He didn't even look at my x-rays or anything. He's like, we should cut it off. So I didn't like that guy.
Right.
So I was like, I'm not going to let this guy cut my leg off, especially knowing how I feel. And she goes, where would you go? Should we go to Walter Reed again? That's where I went. I was like, yeah, I don't know anybody up there. I said, you know where I want to go? I want to go to CFI, Center for the Intrepid. Look it up if you haven't seen it. It's in San Antonio, Texas. It's at Fort Sam Houston, Brooke Army Medical Center.
Right.
It's 6 floors, 65,000 square feet, Olympic quality training for our mission's amputees. So I was fortunate she made a phone call. The next day, they called me, and they sent me orders and sent me a plane ticket. I got there January 25th or something like that. I had to do a week worth of in processing. When I landed there, I weighed 171 pounds. A week later, February 8th, I had my surgery scheduled. I reported for surgery. I weighed 161 pounds.
What happened? We lost him. What the hell? He hung up. Stand by. Anthony Dries, my guess. What happened? Hello?
Hey.
What happened?
I don't know. Where was I? What did you hear?
I just heard delete, and you went away. Did you?
Oh, well, where was I in the story?
You had gone from 171 pounds to 161 pounds, and I said,
okay.
Why?
Oh, cancer. It was killing me. It was eating me away.
Okay, got it.
And then on February 8th, I had my surgery. After they cut my leg off, I weighed 143.
Whoa.
In a week. You understand that, right? I went from 171 to 140. That's 30 pounds of my body. It's like 20% or whatever. But the cool thing, it's not really cool, but the doctor told me about this thing called a ketamine flush. He said it's basically a reset to your physiological and your chemical so that you don't have that addiction to opioids anymore. I was like, yeah, sign me up. He said, it's a little tough. I said, all right, I'm good for tough. That thing was the craziest psychedelic trip that I've ever had in my life. And it has to be because I'm not really a drug user. But I would say it borderline closer to brutal than tough. But the very next day, I woke up. I was hopping around the hospital. I had no pain pills. Everybody's looking at me like, look at you. I was like, yeah, that's what I came here for, man. Let's go. The long and short of it is they told me that a 23-year-old, it would take them anywhere from 9 months to 12 months to have the surgery and recover from it. And I was back this is in San Antonio, Texas. I was back in Denver in 122 days. I was back at work.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay, so your path.
74 surgery, sir. 74.
74.
Total number, 74.
Okay, so I've got 7 minutes left. All right, okay. And Anthony, and I'll have you back on. I promise it because
absolutely, I'd love to.
Because we, by very separate paths, come to the same conclusions about truth and veterans and things like that. So when you go talk to other people, you've lived a number of incredible lives, to include your survival from something that, would you say, killed 29 or 21?
29, sir.
29. What are the lessons that you give to people that come to hear you talk?
What I say to people is, when you think about your life, you never really gain perspective until the mother of your buddy comes into your ICU room from his ICU room and brings you the flowers that she meant for him. And then she sits there and she stares at you and she looks at you and then actually she touches you and holds on to you because you were the last person to see her son alive. From that moment on, I knew that there was 29 parents, kids, family members, relatives, friends, whatever, whose prayers and tears to this day are still unanswered. Don't make your life be a waste. Make sure that if you ever have to account and meet these people again, heaven or earth, that you can say, I'm sorry for your loss, but with my life, I did this. And that's how I live my life every day.
Have you seen a movie that Elizabeth Smart made entitled I Am Elizabeth Smart?
Maybe it doesn't ring a bell, though.
Okay. It would if you saw it. All right.
Okay.
Write that down. She's a girl that
got
kidnapped in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her message. She produced this movie, and she comes on during breaks in the movie. And I want you to watch that because her message is the same. Life will impact you, okay? But do not allow those things that impact you to define your life. You define your life.
Right. Yep, and I say that as I'm reading my notes from an interview I did. Situations refine you, not define you. You don't get into being a victim, but you got to focus on being victorious every day.
So when we talk about relative to post-combat related mental health, when we talk about that, and we talk about, look, you come from the warrior caste, You all of a sudden you didn't become a pile of junk. Okay, you're still that warrior. You may have put on a little weight, and you might not shave every day, but you still have that inside of you. All you need to do is be trained.
Activate it. Yeah.
Right. Activated, trained. Yeah. Call it what you would. That all you need and to understand, right, what's happened to you, and then the wellness practices that you need to adopt so that you can live the life you want to live. And so, to me, you hear us talk, and then you see the default treatment is here's your bag of drugs, this one for anxiety, this one for sleep, for anger, and then go to group therapy on Wednesday afternoon at 2.
Okay, thank you for saying that, because we only have a few seconds left.
That creates, in my opinion, that creates dependency.
It does create dependency, and if you look at the number one and number two side effects of those things, depression and suicidal tendencies are on every suicidal or every mental wellness medicine they give you. Those are the side effects. I was talking to a veteran the other day. He was bragging about the kind of medicine they're giving him, and they send me extras. I get them every 2 weeks. I was like, yeah, they're killing you. They're getting paid to kill us. And so I don't want to say it like that, because that sounds true, and I don't want to start that stuff. But what I will tell you, I don't care if you paint, if you meditate, if you play with ponies or puppies or shoot archery or rock climb or knife throw or whatever you do, as long as you're not out hurting some other individual, do that besides doing the pills. Do that before you do it. Take some time and learn who you are. I want to say this to all warriors.
Wow.
What you said, Michael, maybe we a little bit overweight, a little this and that. Yeah, maybe we were also when we first joined the military. So like you said, it's in us to maintain ourselves. But keep in mind, everybody's watching us. So you say, oh, yeah, I was in the Army, and you're not taking care of yourself. Who is going to want to be in that group? Do you look like the person that, I want to be like that when I grow up, fat and out of shape? And I'm not saying anything about weight. I'm not saying about out of shape. I'm saying no matter what shape you're in, the point of being in the military is always trying to improve yourself. That doesn't stop. It's a lifestyle. It's a life mission. That's your mission. Improve yourself. You're always better your position, always improving yourself. And if you're not working on that, that's probably why you're not gratified. We're mission-oriented beings, right? If we don't have a mission, it's hard for us, and then we get hopeless. Hopeless is a dangerous spot for us. So anything besides opioids. And I'm telling you, I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not telling you to flush all your opioids. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is look for practitioners in your area, and there's free programs that do it. Learn meditation, learn yoga, learn about yourself. My elements happen to be water and music. If I sit in a hot tub and jam out, I can get myself together in most cases. In some cases, when I'm too far triggered, I have people that I call. Like, look, I'm blown up right now. Can you help me through this? And we help each other through it.
And those are just the wellness practices that you've learned that allow you to live the life that you want and not have to be on those medications.
Yep, and I don't take nothing. I don't take an aspirin or nothing. Not nothing. The other day they were like, give us your medication. No, nothing. I don't take nothing. I just see all my stuff. And I had several surgeries. So after every surgery, they dope you up again. So I only got the ketamine thing one time. So every time I had surgery, that was for surgery number 60, for number 70 when they cut off my leg. Yeah, they did the ketamine thing. After that, every other surgery, they knock me out and then they give me the opioid. So I gave myself a policy. My policy was after surgery, I'll take them till midnight of that night. The next day I'm off.
Wow.
They hated me. But then they looked up and said, wow. Yeah, because opioids, what you don't understand, they don't ease your pain. They knock your sharpness off. But what they also do is reduce your ability to have less sensitivity to pain versus the opposite. If you didn't take medicine and if you worked out, because of the blood flow to those areas, it reduces your sensitivity. Think about the guys that work out. Working out, being an athlete, is a relationship with pain, right? Like you have to ignore it and push through it to do what you want to do. So why does that change your life? Don't tell me how bad your back hurts. Don't tell me about what I know. I got blown up by a bomb. I know. I get it. And the thing that got blown up, I kept it for almost 30 years. I know about pain. I'm never not in pain. The point is I can manage my pain or I can manage my mind so my pain can't stop me from living my life. Opioids don't allow that.
His name is Anthony Dries. He should have been a Marine, but he wound up in the Army. That's his own issue. Anthony, where do people learn more about you? And I will give you a call either later on today or tomorrow, and we'll come back on and we'll talk about more specifics on certain issues. But how do people find your work, what you do? Because I know you do a lot of work.
I do. I'm busy. Look me up on Facebook. Anthony Greese is the easiest way to find me. You'll see I post all the videos of my warrior journey. I'm also the executive director of Veterans Passport to Hope. That's V as in Victor, T as in Papa, 2 as the number 2, H as in Hotel. VP2H.org. You can check us out there. We're doing some great work in the community. We have a three-pillar mission of cooperation, awareness, and fundraising. Since 2012, we've helped 11,000 Colorado veterans and their family locally. And our mission, we basically hold a series of fundraising events throughout the year, and we give the money away to the top veterans organizations in our state, and actually some in some other states. And the thing that we require, we vet them, we vet their application, and we make sure that they are able to document impact in the veteran community, and then we supercharge them. We give them all the money we raise. In the meantime, we make corporate-style videos, and we hold symposiums and all kinds of other stuff to make sure that they stay in business operating at the highest level. We give them our personal business expertise and acumen so that these nonprofits have the resources that any corporation would have because we serve veterans.
Wow, that's awesome. All right, his name is Anthony Drees. Anthony, first of all, thanks for doing this. It's been an awesome hour. And I will be in touch. And give that website out one more time.
It's vp2h.org, or look for me on Facebook under Anthony Drees. If you want to talk to me, if you want to hit me up, you can hit me up. Tony Drees. My last name is like trees, but with a D instead. So TONYDREES, 1782@gmail.com. 1782 is the year of the Purple Heart. It'll help you remember.
There you have it. Wow. Well done. Well done. All right. No, thank you. We're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.